Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 182. Our guest this week is a gaming historian, a streamer, a game developer, a co-host of a rival podcast. Should I call it a rival podcast? Co-host of the Player One podcast, producer of Generation 16, and former editor for Electronic Gaming Monthly, has also written in Expert Gamer and other publications. We have Greg Seward. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So the Player One podcast, you've been doing for 17 years.
Yes.
Weekly. Yep.
Yes. Yeah, it was born of, it was started by Chris Johnston and myself. Chris Johnston, also another former Electronic Gaming Monthly editor. He was the news editor. We worked together at Ziff Davis at Electronic Gaming Monthly for a few years. He was there much longer than I was. And we both kind of left right as 1UP.com was becoming a thing. And of course, with that came the podcasts and the 1UP show and, of course, 1UP Yours, which was hugely popular. And everybody listened to it, and CJ and I as well. And we used to sit and play. We both loved the Burnout series. So we would sit and play Burnout. And of course, I was living back in Nova Scotia, where I'm from and where I am currently, and he was actually living in Atlanta at the time. So the way we kept in touch was to play Burnout and chat while we were playing Burnout. And at one point, one of us said, like, you know, this is like us talking to each other feels like an episode of something like 1UP Yours, because we've both been in the industry for quite a while. Maybe we should record this and just see if people want to listen to it. And that was really the origin of it. Like, we grabbed a couple of SOCOM headsets from that old PlayStation 2 game, and because they worked on the PC, and plugged them in, and away we went. And if you go back and listen to the first episode, it's absolutely terrible.
Well, leads me to, like, was there any concern or thought put into, like, okay, we don't just want it to be like two friends talking about, like, inside jokes or whatever. Like, was there any sort of thought, like, okay, how do we make this accessible to people we don't know?
I think really the thought that was put into it, there wasn't a lot. We actually wanted to trade on the fact that we were quite close. I mean, CJ came to my wedding. I went to his wedding. Like, he was my closest friend when I worked at Ziff Davis, and we just really hit it off. And so that was kind of the chemistry is what we wanted to come across. But when we started like everybody else who was emulating, you know, the one or two very popular podcasts at the time. Again, 1UP Yours being probably the biggest one. In that, you know, well, we want to talk about the current news. We want to be playing the most current games and give our thoughts on them. I mean, it really was a what you've been playing show, and it always kind of has remained that way. And then we brought in Phil Theobald, who was also someone else who worked at Ziff Davis, and we were close with him as well. And it's kind of evolved from there. I would say if you go back and listen to our earliest episodes, the only thought we gave to being accessible was that we were just like everyone else. And then we sort of grew into ourselves over the next 17 years.
I do love, as far as going back to old episodes, on your Patreon, it recommends starting with episode 300, if you're unfamiliar with the show. And then if you click on the link and go to that episode, the description on the episode says, if you're new to the show, don't start here.
I don't even remember what 300 was about.
I have to go back myself. I just wrote that. I thought that was very funny. I think it's an interview, actually. You've got a guest on it.
Oh yeah, we were very we had high aspirations. One of our earliest episodes was an interview with I can't remember his name, but he did the translation for early Squaresoft games. He was the one who was responsible for the Spoony Bard line in Final Fantasy II.
Here. Oh, that's a good get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we had the creator of the Leisure Suit Larry series on very early as well, Al Lowe, who was like a bit of a hero to Phil and I. And so we did like some really relatively big interviews, because the nice thing we had going for us that I think a lot of startups don't normally have is that we were all games industry and games media vets by that point, right? We'd all been in the game for like 10 or so years. So we had a little bit of pull. We weren't, you know, it wasn't like EGM or IGN was reaching out to these people to do interviews, but we at least had the chops and we had the history that we could say, yeah, but you know, we're somebody too, and some people fell for it, surprisingly enough. So So yeah, but then we settled into a bit of a groove after that, and we have the odd interview now, but we had really, really big aspirations 17 years ago.
You mentioned burnout. You're really into racing games, and you really go all out for, you have a Player One Podcast Racing League, and it's not, you don't even just have trophies for first place. You've got trophies for second and third place.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I grew up around racing. My dad and my uncle both raced stock cars before I was born. But when I was born, the day I was christened, we were at church in the morning, and then my dad went to run a race in the afternoon. We all went from, you know, changed out of, well, I mean, I was a baby. We changed out of our church clothes and we went to the racetrack. And about the only time we didn't go to church when I was growing up is when we had to go to the races. But it's just always been a big part of my life. My uncle is a Canadian Hall of Fame driver. So, you know, I've always been a big fan of racing, and it's always been something I've loved about video games. But one of the things that really gelled for us for this league that we're running is the pandemic. Everyone was stuck at home. And if you remember, there were a few things that were really got really big, and esports was one of them, of course, because a lot of sports fans lost, you know, the chance to watch live sports. And as race fans, a lot of us lost the chance to watch any live racing. But we also had some extra money. We also had people sitting around who had copies of Gran Turismo Sport. And just, man, wouldn't it be fun if we created a racing league? And so we did, because everyone had the time and the cash to sort of spend a little bit on racing rigs and stuff like that. And it's just kind of held on since then. It's one of the things that I love about our show, and this extends to my YouTube channel as well, is that we don't have the biggest audience, which, I mean, it would be great if it was bigger, but we have a very loyal and very friendly community that I'm super proud of. It's small, but I always call it just small but mighty. And just like everything else that we kind of get into as a group or a subset of the group, it just becomes one of the best experiences ever. And I actually credit the racing league that we have for getting me through some pretty tough times. And I've had other members of our league come and say the same thing. It's something that we all look forward to every couple of weeks, just to hang out and go racing for an hour. It's fantastic.
On your Discord, the way you guys talk about it, it sounds like you're going to a real event.
Yeah, yeah, it's gotten pretty serious at this point. So,
funny enough, mentioning your dad and your uncle there. So I was obviously researching you before this, and your uncle kept coming up because, yeah, Canadian Motorsport Hall of Fame. And then I'm like looking at you, and I'm like, wait a minute, they're from the same place. They have the same name, and he likes racing. And it took me a while, but oh, I see.
When I was a kid, the best part about that was that, of course, yeah, I'm named after my uncle. And he, for some reason, the phone number that reporters had was actually my dad's number. So, and if I happened to be home in the day and somebody called and they asked for Greg Seward, I would say, oh, speaking, you know, when I was a kid. And I guess my voice was deep enough that they didn't think they were talking to a child, and they would just launch into a series of questions about the most recent race or something like that. And I, you know, was being, I guess, you know, you're Canadian, you know, you don't want to interrupt them. You don't want to be rude. And so I would let them get through their spiel and their question before I would tell them, like, you're actually looking for my uncle. I'm not the driver that you're looking for.
Did you ever like try to give an answer?
No, never. I was way too scared to do anything like that. I thought I'd get in trouble if I did something.
I mean, probably better for your uncle that you don't. Yeah.
yeah. Most likely.
Well, what's the best racing game all time?
Oh man, that's rough. I would say for me, I'm a very nostalgic gamer, and I would never pass up a chance to play Outrun. Sit down and play a run through that game. When 1UP arcade cabinets started becoming a thing, I said, you know, if they ever release Outrun, that'll be the first cab I buy. And lo and behold, they did. And that is the one I bought. That is sitting down in my den right now. And I usually sit down in front of that once or twice a week.
I'm terrible at racing games, but I've, I said this to friends before. I don't think I've ever said it on the podcast, but there's something about racing video games to me. It's such a pure gaming experience. There's just something that's like, oh, this is what a video game is. I don't know how I could explain that, like what I mean there, but I don't know. There's just so like you're locked in. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting because I'm as I've gotten older, and it's something that we both gets on our show, both get celebrated for and also get a fair amount of crap for, is we all pretty famously reduce our game difficulties down to like family mode or easy mode or something like that, which, again, some of our listeners think it's pretty weak, and a lot of them are pretty much on board with it. But of course, especially in this day and age where you've got like all the Souls games and how you have Souls likes where it's just like, you know, the whole idea is you can't make a single mistake. Like you just have to really master what you're doing, which I have huge respect for. I don't have the patience to practice and get that good at something like that. But I also look at it from a standpoint of like, that's what racing games to me have always been. You know, if you're doing well, you're going very fast. You use a very, very slim margin for error, and usually any mistake will be catastrophic to your run. So, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like that's where, for me, that's what I get that feeling. It's exhilarating, as I'm sure it's exhilarating for people who are really good at like Souls games.
You have a story about, well, it's a speculative story about how you got your first Atari 2600, because you say your dad bought it, but you don't really know why, because your dad wasn't really into that kind of thing. Right. But you also talk about how Monaco GP was such a huge game for you. Was there any game, any racing games, you know, back in the day that your dad or your uncle would have been like, oh, this is my thing?
No, it's weird. I mean, my dad was not a gamer at all. I think that the 2600 that we had, I mean, I was born in 76, so, you know, that was right at the right time. I think the 2600 we had was actually something my father may have bought for my uncle, who was 10 years his junior, and then ended up hanging on to after he kind of moved on from it. But he would watch games, but he wasn't really into games. But he would, if he ever saw like a, I'd say like a Daytona cabinet or something like that, because he's a big stock car racing guy, a stock car fan. So anything that looked like stock car racing, he would stop and look at, but he would never, ever, ever pick up a joystick and play it. He would watch me play something. The only game I ever remember seeing him ever pick up a controller or drop a coin in an arcade machine and play would be Capcom 1942 or 1943 series, because he was a big warplane lover as well. He loved World War II warplanes, so he saw that, and he would always, that would be it, like years and years later. I remember seeing him do that when I was a kid, when we were on trips, because back in the day, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't weird to go into like the vending machine area in a motel and there'd be a solitary arcade cabinet standing there, or you know, go to a Pizza Hut or something and they'd have an arcade cabinet there. And I remember distinctly remember going on vacation in Maine one year, and we were at a motel, and down by the ice machine was a 1942 machine, and he went out of his way to go play it. And that's the only time I ever remember seeing him play a video game. And years later, I'm talking many years later, like in the past 10 years, I think we had a Christmas party or a New Year's party going, and I busted out Tetris because somebody mentioned they would love to play Tetris again. And while people were sitting around playing it, my dad pulled me aside and said, "Can you get 1942 on that thing?" So subsequently, I downloaded an emulator for his laptop and loaded up at the 1942 game. And he would still fire it up every now and then. It was really neat.
Cool. My mom, not that long ago, told me, so I have three siblings, and she told me, "Oh, I played Battlefront." She didn't say Battlefront, she didn't know what it was, but she's like, I played this game with your nephew. It's like 37 years you never played a game with me.
yeah exactly. And I bet you if my kids had said, "Grampy, would you play a game with us?" he probably would have done it in a heartbeat,
right?
But not with his own kids. No.
Can you tell us how internet chat rooms led to your early internet chat rooms, that is, led to your games journalism career?
Sure. So I remember actually probably even before internet chat rooms, it was probably Usenet. So we never had a PC in our house when I was growing up, not until I was like 17 or 18 years old. And even then, I don't think we weren't on the internet right away. But that was around the time, obviously, that I was getting to college age. And when I started university, you could go into the computer lab. And the computer lab back then, I mean, on Friday night, it was just people going and surfing the internet. And I remember I take a buddy of mine because he didn't have the internet at his place either, which is it almost sounds alien to say that now. But, you know, back then when it was all dial up, a lot of us, if we even had computers, didn't necessarily have an internet connection. So we would go in because we were big Sega, especially Saturn nerds. And we would go to the SMU computer lab and surf Saturn fan sites like Dave Sega Saturn page and stuff like that. And somehow along the way, it must have been a link on one of those pages, we discovered Usenet. And like Rec Video Games Sega and Rec Video Games Nintendo and just Rec Video Games and everything like that. And so I became very active on Usenet. And when we finally did get an internet connection at home, I spent a lot of time posting on those Rec Video Games boards and kind of started making connections. And I don't remember the name of the guy who was looking for writers, but there was someone who was looking for writers for a website called Daily Gamer. And he just sort of put a call out on Usenet. And I answered that call along with another guy named Jim Cordera, who I'd seen on Usenet off and on. And anyway, he accepted us as writers and we started writing for the page. And almost immediately, we were sort of drawn into another website called, what was it called? Gaming Enthusiast Online, which was run by a guy named Sam Kennedy, who I also worked with at Ziff Davis. And they were using MIRC to chat with each other. And so we joined MIRC, and there was a chat room in there called VidGames, hashtag VidGames, which just so happened to be the hangout spot for tons of people from Ziff Davis and a few people from GameFan as well. So John Riccardi was there, and Mark McDonald was there before he was Ziff Davis, and Che Chow was there before he was Ziff Davis. And again, there's some editors from GameFan in there as well. And Craig Cuyava, who at one point was the editor-in-chief of Official PlayStation Magazine and who I worked with at EGM as well. There were just tons of people in there who were either in the industry or about to be in the industry. And when we got in there and we kind of started becoming part of the group, was around the same time that Sam, who had started Gaming Enthusiast, was trying to break away from his publisher. So a bunch of us got together. Sam, Jim, and I were three of us, and there were a few others. Brady Fichter, who ended up working at one of Dave Halverson's other magazines as well, and Dave Toole, who worked at GameSpot eventually, came together to create the website Gaming Age. We founded Gaming Age, and it kind of became the sort of de facto fan site of Vid Games. And so a lot of people who started at that site or who came through that site would go on to game industry positions. There were tons of people who wrote for Gaming Age, basically because the people at Ziff Davis wanted to hire them, but they needed to have something that had been published online first. So they would come and write a few reviews for us. They'd use that as their portfolio and then they'd move on. But we had an amazing run of people who worked with us or for us who ended up going on to game industry positions. Like Patrick Klepek is another one. He got his start there as well. There's a couple Giant Bomb guys now who were Vid Games people as well. So I've often thought of, and I've actually started and stopped this project many times, but I'd love to put together either a series of interviews in podcast form or as a video of just people who were in Vid Games back in the mid and late 90s, because so many of them went on to be game developers and games media and influencers and things like that. It would be really neat.
This is a perfect segue to bring up. You are quoted, I'm paraphrasing here, but you're quoted in Kyle Orland's The Game Beat as saying that when you got into games journalism, you knew you wanted to be like a developer at some point, which you went on to do. You know, did you have any dev experience before working for EGM, or did you learn anything like that while you were there?
No, not at all. I was, well, yes, I learned a little bit while I was there, but I was a university dropout when I started at EGM. It was very much like all that stuff that I just described happened after I had, I mean, it started when I was starting in university, but a couple years later, I was out of university. And so I was working crappy part-time jobs and some full-time jobs while I was working on this website. And thank God it worked. Because that's how I ended up with a career. But yeah, that I had nothing but enthusiasm and some writing ability to start up with. But what I did get while I was working at Ziff Davis and at EGM was exposed to a lot of developers and exposed to a lot of their stories. And it definitely gave me a bigger appreciation for what went into creating games at the time, as well as, you know, there's always an element of just a general knowledge and a breadth of knowledge and a breadth of experience with games. Sometimes that's enough. And the first game development job I had was as a level designer at Vicious Cycle. And I didn't need dev experience for that because it was all scripting. It was just a very simple scripting language that I was using. And I wasn't designing, like I wasn't building anything or writing any code. I was taking pieces and I was designing encounters and you know, following story beats and stuff like that. So you didn't really need a coding background for that, which was nice.
What is the most bizarre ad you remember from your magazine career? Print ad, that is.
There was an ad for a Virtua Tennis for the Sega Dreamcast, which was a bunch of naked old men in a locker room. And we got, it was so funny because we didn't, even up until the point that the issue was being sent to the printer, we didn't get to see the ads. Like we were given, I forget the proper term for these, but you would get like this big sort of grid and it would show you how many pages you had to work with. But it would also be like, and here's the layout, right? Because basically the way it worked is every page sold for an ad equaled a page of editorial, right? So that's how it paid for itself. And so you'd know, like you'd see this layout and you'd like, okay, this page is going to be editorial, then there's like a one page ad here, then there's a half page ad on the next spread, and then there's a full spread two page ad. And you would normally see at least the company and what product they were selling, but that was usually it. So at least most of us editors, maybe Dan Hsu, who was the editor in chief for most of the time I was there, maybe he saw what the ads looked like before they went up, but I don't think he did. So you'd see that layout and you would only see the editorial that you worked on. So you wouldn't actually see the ads that had been placed in those spots until you got the early copies back from the printer, which at that point, nothing was going to change. That's what the issue was going to look like. And I remember, I don't know which issue it was, but I remember we saw that ad and we're like, oh my God, like, what is this? It was, I wouldn't even call it tasteful, you know, and I'm not prude in the least, but it was just like, it was very off-putting.
I mean, it surely was censored in some way.
It wasn't like you were, there was one guy that I seem to remember sitting like back to the camera. And I mean, you know, there was a lot of his ass showing. A lot of his hairy, old, wrinkly, you know, and it's just like, and we got so many complaints about that ad. Like we had so many complaints about that advertisement. So it always sticks out. That was just like, I think Sega pulled it the next month, but it definitely left a mark. I mean, here we are 20 years on.
I mean,
the first thing that pops to mind.
I guess I don't pay attention really now, but old, like early 90s, that'd be my era of games advertising, was insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like completely bonkers. None of it had anything to do with the game itself. It would just be off the wall.
And it ranged so dramatically in quality too. For the YouTube series and the YouTube videos that I do, it's all of course steeped in retro gaming and early 90s and stuff like that. So I spend a fair amount of time sifting through those old issues, and it's so funny to me how you'll see decent ads, you know, or at least you can see that there was money spent. But then you'll turn the page and then it's like a title with a bunch of clip art as a full page ad too. Like it's really all over the map.
So you went from Atari to the NES, which you have pointed out that we just called Nintendo. And then you went to the Genesis. Mm-hmm. And I know you played NHL hockey on the Genesis. And I know you're a Penguins fan, and I assumed because of Sidney Crosby, but you've been a Penguins fan, since at least 2000. I don't know how early you went. So that's before Sid the Kid. How did you become a Penguins fan?
So for me, it was, you know what? I think it was Rebellion more than anything else, because around here in the 80s, again, I'm from Nova Scotia, so around here in the 80s and 90s, you were either a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, you're a Montreal Canadiens fan, or a Boston Bruins fan. And I come from a huge family full of Boston Bruins fans. Like my dad, my uncle, my brother, my other uncle. Like I don't know if my grandfather was. He may have been. He died when I was very young. But they're all Bruins fans. And I wasn't even a big sports kid. I wasn't big into hockey. But it was one of those things where it's like, well, you know, I followed it because you couldn't help it. There was one TV in the house and my dad loved hockey. So hockey was on. When it was hockey night in Canada, hockey was on. So, of course, that's from the era of Wayne Gretzky as well. So, I mean, you could be an Edmonton Oilers fan because of the great one. But that also kind of felt like, well, everybody does that. So that was when Lemieux was getting really big, really popular. And he was the magnificent one. He was the next one. So I was like, well, I'm going to go with Lemieux. He's exciting. I loved watching him play. I thought he was awesome. So he's like, he seems like he'd be fun to cheer for. And I just kind of picked the Penguins. And then, of course, they ended up winning the Cup 2 years in a row in the early 90s when I was in high school, which was.
So you look like a bandwagon fan.
Oh, my God. No, I was a fan just before I sort of came out as a Penguins fan. So I was wearing the Penguins hats and stuff like that and surrounded by my high school friends who were way more jock than I was, who were all about the Leafs and the Canadians and the Bruins. And here's the Penguins just spanking them all for like 2 or 3 years in a row. And of course, that was when hockey video games were getting big and you were getting NHLPA licenses and NHL licenses. So they were using stats. And of course, because the Penguins were so good, they were the best team in the game almost every year, or one of the best teams. So I could play as my favorite team and kick everyone's butts. It was great. It was awesome. And then Crosby was just a happy coincidence. I mean, there were dark, dark years for the Penguins after that. And then Crosby came along and they started winning cups again. So it was great. And he's from here. So that's even better.
Despite being a Winnipegger, I am a lifelong Edmonton fan. I'm just too late for Gretzky, but I am not too late for Mark Messier. Moving on. So the Genesis, though, how does a notorious Genesis fan such as yourself end up contributing to Brett Weiss's SNES Omnibus project?
I think I was introduced to Brett through Chris Baker, who was another Ziff Davis alumnus. He was on the official PlayStation magazine. He and I were roommates when we lived in Chicago for about a year. We were roommates, and he's been on our show multiple times. And I think Brett, like the way Brett works is he likes to reach out I think all of his contacts, but he had reached out to Chris and I think had said, like, if you know anybody else who might be interested, you know, please drop them a line. So that was kind of how I got sort of tangled up in Brett's books. But I mean, you know, notorious Genesis fan for sure, but played everything, loved everything. So. Just, you know, I mean, Super Nintendo still sucks, but Genesis for life.
How
but
dare
I'll still
you.
Write about Super Nintendo getting just kidding.
The name of this podcast is literally named after the Super Nintendo. So Generation 16 is your ode to the Genesis, if you will. It started out, you wanted to play chronologically every single Mega Drive Genesis title, but it became more than that. It became a history lesson, really. You know, you really get in depth at the gaming scene at the time of each game you're playing. At what point did you decide, okay, I want this to be more than I'm just playing every game?
I don't know. Like, I don't know exactly what point it became that. The whole thing was inspired by Crontendo, by Dr. Sparkle. I thought that just seemed like a lot of fun. It's like, oh, well, no one's doing Genesis, I'll do that. And yeah, it's just an excuse to sit down and play. If you look at the very earliest episodes of Generation 16, they're like 3 or 4 minutes long. And that's all it is me playing it and saying, this is good, this is bad, let's move on. But I think it's a throwback to really the reason I got into the games media to begin with. In the 90s, I, you know, of course, pre-internet for a lot of us, I was just absorbing every bit of information I could about video games. And it's like, you know, reading Game Fan and Game Pro and EGM, and especially if they had a developer interview or something, I would just pore over those pages and I'd read them over and over again and commit them to memory and that sort of thing. And then Next Generation came along, Next Generation Magazine, which was just the North American version of Edge, as far as I know. And it was very much a trade paper more than a consumer magazine. But it was like it was eye opening. And to be able to read these like long form interviews with especially video game executives and things like that, but to get a real look into sort of the stories behind what was happening, like, you know, talking to Tom Kalinske post surprise launch of the Saturn and how that all fell apart, and talking to the Tramiels about the Jaguar and sort of how it happened and, you know, how it went, and looking at all the interviews with the heads, the revolving door of Sony executives that happened with the launch of the PlayStation, about leading up to it, where, you know, it was supposed to be really good hardware, but I think a lot of people don't remember how a lot of us didn't have tons of faith in Sony as a video game company at the time. And then to see that sort of revolution happen, and interviews in the aftermath and that sort of thing, it's always been my favorite part of the games industry and the games media, is sort of those kinds of stories. And it just sort of naturally evolved. Generation 16 kind of naturally evolved that way, where it's like, well, I read a ton of these history books, I have a ton of these old interviews. So it sort of began with, like, I have an inkling or a memory that I read something about this game somewhere that's just this sort of interesting little tidbit that I want to include, and sort of doing that for a little while. And then following some other video game history YouTube series in particular, where they were getting developer interviews, and it kind of hit me. It's like, hey, you've been doing this stuff for 20 years. You've done interviews, you know how to do interviews. Why aren't you reaching out to these people? If you can find the people who actually worked on these games and talk to them, that would make this, I think, way more interesting, at least for like-minded people. And so, yeah, it went from like a 3-minute segment to now, if an episode's shorter than 20 or 25 minutes, then it's an oddity. It also makes them a lot longer to make too, but it's so great. And further to that, I love being able to reach out and talk to people about games that don't have a ton of coverage. One of the things that the series has evolved to as well is I ended up picking myself up a Pioneer Laser Active, which is a console I think a lot of people don't even really know about, but it's a Laserdisc player that has modules that will play NEC, PC Engine or TurboGrafx games and Sega Genesis games. And not only will it play cartridges, but it'll play the CD-ROM games that those respective systems had. But further to that, it created two new platforms, which was the LD-ROM-ROM and the Mega LD games, which there are very few of. There's not a lot of coverage of most of them. So that, to me, has been sort of the most fascinating and the most fun to dig into. I ended up tracking down the creator of a terrible game called I Will, The Story of London. It took me forever to get the interview. It took me forever to put the episode together. I don't think more than like 300 or 400 people have actually watched the episode, but it's one of the things I'm the most proud of, because it was just a bunch of information that isn't generally out there on the internet. And it was so gratifying to find it and to package it up and to get it out there.
When you interview someone like that, do they know it's a terrible game?
I don't know. And speaking as someone who's worked on some pretty terrible games, I don't think you find too many people who've worked on a game like that or created a game like that who are delusional about how well it was received, especially, you know, 20 or 30 years on, or 30 or 40 years on, really, at this point with some of these people. But I'm always very careful to be very respectful of not only when I'm doing the interview, but also I try to be in my videos along with the interviews where, you know, I Will is a great example. I know it's a terrible game, but one of the things that I've actually really started to be put off in recent years with retro gaming content on the internet is it's a very easy and disrespectful out to run footage of a game just to point at it and laugh. Mm-hmm. As much as I know that's popular, I'm more interested in the story behind it. You know, if it was successful or wasn't successful is absolutely something worth talking about, and I try to make sure that I do talk about that. But speaking as someone, again, who's worked on his share of not great games, I know that you don't go into these endeavors looking to make a crappy game. You know, there's usually a vision there. Sometimes the vision isn't realized. Sometimes the vision was impossible to realize with the current tech, with the talent of the team, with the budget that they had available to them. You know, sometimes you just can't get to that point. But to me, the interesting part is what that vision was and the work they did to try to make it. And also, yes, if they got there or not. But running something for 10 minutes just to point and laugh at it and call it garbage is not something I'm interested in doing.
Moving on to your streaming, how close are you to having raised lifetime $100,000 for the IWK Foundation through Extra Life?
I surpassed it about a month ago.
Oh, well then, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Well, how's that feel?
Awesome. It feels, I don't even really know how to describe it. When I started raising money for Extra Life, it was 14 years ago. And it was just something that a fellow podcaster reached out and said, "Do you want to be on my team?" I'd never heard of it before. And I was like, "Yeah, sure. This sounds fun. I get to play video games for 24 hours and it's for a good cause." And raised, I think, $770 that year. And I thought, there's no way I'll ever do more than that. And now in the last few years, it's very regular to raise over $10,000. And when I saw that I was nearing that $100,000 mark, I just kind of set that as my main goal. Honestly, everything after that is gravy. I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep raising funds for Extra Life. But I feel like I've accomplished what I wanted to do. I didn't realize when I set out that was what I wanted to accomplish, but I think it was as soon as I looked at my grand total and saw it was somewhere in like the 70,000 range, I was like, I can hit that 100,000 mark, no problem.
You do a 24-hour stream, you know, the Extra Life 24-hour stream every year, and I've watched the final minutes of a couple of them, and when that clock hits 24 hours, you are out. You're like, done.
Yeah, it's not easy to do. I feel silly saying that because I'm sitting there playing video games. You know, it's not like I'm not running a marathon or anything like that. But, man, 24 hours, especially the older you get, 24 hours is a long time to stay up. But, it's, you know, again, I have a small but very dedicated, very, loyal following who I think, I mean, I would never take the time to go back and do this. And I don't even know if the site keeps the stats for me to do it. But I think if I went back and really broke down how much had been donated by which people over the last 14 years, it will be shocking how few names that actually is for the total we got to.
I did see, I won't say the name just in case, but I did see one person in particular, a $950 donation at the very end of your last one.
Yeah, I'll say his name because he actually did it on the stream, and that is a very good friend of mine named Mike White. And actually, if people listen to our show, we we regularly call out CJ's best friend, Mike. That is the same guy. Mike's been a personal friend of mine, a local guy, for, oh, I don't know, 20 or so years. And he's very generous, not only with his time, but with his wallet. I mean, he's the guy who, for years and years and years, if you've been watching our streams, he's the guy who will come over and through the overnight and usually stay until morning, just because he feels like it's the right thing to do. And yeah, he put us over the top this year with that donation.
Well, that also leads to, what are some tips for anyone, you know, because I agree, now that I'm older, like, never mind 24 hours, like, I can't stay up past 10 o'clock. You know, what are some tips you have if you're doing this kind of thing? How do you stay up? How do you stay, you know, coherent?
This year, I got very lucky in that I had a couple of other very good friends of mine who just recently moved to Maine, and they drove up for the weekend. They've been regular donors through the years as well. And they actually, bless them, like, they just bought a house. So they reached out and said, look, we can't afford to donate what we normally would this year because we just bought a house. And, you know, it's like, that's fine. That's what, why would I ever, you know, you give what you can. They said, well, we have a meaning to make a trip up. So instead, what we want to do is donate our time. So they actually made the trip up here and to visit in general. And then they came for the overnight, and I actually got a couple hours sleep in the middle of the night. That's how I got through this year. Previously, it's really been a lot of just making sure you get up, get moving around, have a lot of food, have a lot of keep yourself hydrated, and have somebody there with you. Somebody who's willing. If you're going to stay up the whole time, make sure you've got one or two people who are there with you, who are there to help you stay awake, who are there to talk to you. Because no matter how active your chat is, it's not the same as someone in your ear talking you through it. But even then, you'll be dozing for sure.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, the other option is you could do what I did and have three kids who are, you know, when they're younger, they don't care how tired you are. They'll get up and keep talking your ear off first thing in the morning. So.
Well, last thing I'll ask, actually, are your kids interested in streaming? Are they interested in what you do? Is there any sort of like, well, dad does it, so it must be lame?
They all went through. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. My oldest never went through that phase. She knows what I do and she thinks it's cool, she says, but she doesn't want to do it herself. My son, there was a time when he was very into wanting to stream, and I found, I should probably post these someday. He talked me into letting him stream Minecraft way back in the day. There's some adorable video of it because he's so tiny, sitting in the chair with this big microphone in front of his face playing Minecraft. And then my youngest, she kind of likes the idea, but she likes the idea that I find a lot of young people now like the idea of growing up to be a YouTuber. It's kind of a career ambition more than anything else at the moment. And I think she's kind of gotten over it. So I don't know that any of them want to do it regularly. But they're very respectful of the fact that I do it, and it's sort of definitely a part of their lives. Cause I mean, I stream all year too. And so they know what nights I stream, and they know, you know, if it's past 10 o'clock on those nights, then I'm live. So they're respectful of not being too loud and not running through this shot and you know, not trying to pull me away from it unless it's something important. So yeah, I don't think they'll ever do it themselves though.
Right. As far as the YouTube aspirations, so my nephew used, I don't know if he still does, but he used to, playing games or whatever, he would kind of like talk to a pretend audience as if he was like a mm-hmm. YouTuber. And I know some people, that's kind of like a weird thing. But like, I think about, I used to do similar stuff. And I think about famously Andy Kaufman, you know, who would like have a TV show to his wall, his bedroom wall or whatever. And I totally did that kind of thing. And like, this is just absolutely an extension of that. Like, if they're just using their imagination, I think it's no problem at all.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I mean, and I've seen the exact same thing. All of my kids definitely, well, except the oldest maybe, definitely went through that same phase where there wasn't a camera on them. They're sitting there playing video games and it starts out with like, hey guys, today we're blah, 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 blah. And they'll narrate what they're doing to no one in particular. But you're right. I mean, when I was at, you mentioned how, you know, news radio background, I had a very short stint in news radio. But I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be on TV. I wanted to be a sports broadcaster, and I would absolutely narrate things that were going on around me as though I was speaking to a news camera.
Yeah. All right. Well, people can check you out on YouTube at Sewart. That's S-E-W-A-R-T on Twitch. It is also Sewart. Anywhere else people should find you?
Yeah, on the various, all the different social medias right now, since we haven't settled on one, it seems. Usually, yeah. Honestly, you plug my last name into Google and you'll find me wherever I am.
Or you may find your uncle.
Yes, or you might find my uncle, yeah.
Cool. Well, Greg Sewart, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great.